Welcome to Becoming Parents Podcast. I'm your host, Jennifer Campbell. I'm a doula in Washoe County, Nevada, a Medicaid provider, a lactation educator, childbirth educator, and mom of 18. You can find me and connect on doulainreno.com. Remember, give a shout out to those who are brave enough to share their stories with us on how they have become parents. Let's dive in. Welcome to Becoming Parents. I'm the host, Jennifer Campbell. I'm really excited today. I have Courtney Boyer on. Courtney, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. And I know I said it would come up organically, but your book is right behind your left shoulder. And I just saw it. We pre-gamed and I didn't. So our published author, spoiler alert, sorry about that. Right now, I want to jump in and start on how you became a parent.
Yes. So I became a parent when I was 26. I grew up in the evangelical Christian church, and so it was very much emphasized to marry young, have kids, stay at home, be a supportive helper. And so that's really what I did. I got married at 22, had my first kiddo at 26, and really embraced what it meant to be super mom.
You know, I think that's interesting, though. You took 4 years after you got married in order to have it or to have a child, right? Because I was in the Mormon church for 17 years.
Okay.
We didn't know we had this in common.
Yeah.
And the same, I want to say pressure or expectation that you marry young. A lot of that is because you can't have sex before you get married.
100%. So. Yep.
And then procreation. I still fully believe at how incredible women are at being able to have a baby. I mean, I'm a doula, so like I love that, but I feel like that pressure and stress, but you didn't actually have a baby for 4 years. So you held out in my opinion, you held out.
Yeah, but we had so we got married in undergrad, and then my husband, I got into graduate school, and then my husband was waitlisted for medical school. And so we wanted to wait until towards the end of medical school before having the first kiddo. So there was a method to the madness.
That's amazing. So, but you had a baby at 26.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yep. And then how was that? I mean, take us forward on that. What was the pregnancy like? Did you get pregnant easily?
Yep. I got pregnant easily. It took me the second try. There was the second month. And pregnancy was awful. I was sick a lot. I was on antidepressants or anti-anxiety meds before I got pregnant. And they were like, oh, you should go off of them because, you know, that might be harmful to the baby. So I was like, well, of course I'm going to go off of them. And yet I was struggling with lots of anxiety still. And so then that was a real challenge, being sick and trying to work and navigating your first pregnancy. And then also like feeling like I'm going to miscarry at any second. And there's something wrong with me, like just such this overwhelm of anxiety. So then they were like, yeah, maybe you should go back on your anxiety meds, which I did. And that helped significantly. And then the morning sickness after the first trimester subsided and had a normal pregnancy, ended up having a C-section after being in labor for 23 hours. And that was awful. And I just felt like I was behind when I started motherhood. Like I was so tired, so exhausted.
Oh, okay.
My baby didn't sleep, you know, like all my other friends were like, oh, it's so great being a mom. And I was like, I don't love being a mom. Like it's freaking hard work and I'm tired and we don't have any family nearby. And my husband's in medical school. And like, it was a very lonely journey.
Oh, I mean, I hate that happened to you. I love you expressing that because I think that there's, especially if you're coming, and I don't know if you're still part of that church.
No.
Okay, I'm not either. But so when you get out of that situation, you realize how unrealistic those expectations are. So, wow, I have like so many questions for you because of that. You were on anti-anxiety. How much did the church and the expectations contribute to that? Because I have found that women that I knew in the Mormon church were struggling as much, if not more, as women outside of the church, because the expectations are so strict.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jump in on that.
Yeah. So my friends, my only mom friends in med school were Mormons. And so even though I wasn't Mormon, like that was my community because they were the only other ones who had kids. And so I saw a lot of that pressure that they had. And for me, honestly, I turned to food. Like I gained like 60 pounds during my pregnancy. And I mean, lonely is really the best word I can describe for my pregnancy. And even the first, you know, year of being a mom, because you're being 26 and being married is not common in the medical school world.
Yes.
You know, like most people just aren't doing that. And so like, you're kind of this weirdo that's like, wait, you're married and you have a kid, unless you're Mormon. And then I was like, well, I'm not Mormon, but I'm part of, you know, and whatever. So, it was hard and I didn't feel a pressure actually from my church, but I also didn't feel supported by them either. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting. I mean, it's just, you know, unless you have lived that lifestyle and what those expectations are, it's kind of hard for me to even explain how challenging it was to try to be this perfect member of the church and mom and not lose your mind. I feel like you're kind of set up for failure. And my ex-husband was a dentist. So I was also in the medical field like you were. And anomaly, all the way across the board. It is very lonely. That makes me sad. And because of the anti-anxiety meds and then going back on them, and I'm sure like fear, is something going to happen to the baby? Is this really the best thing? Am I being selfish?
Yep.
Because I'm taking my health over. Right. And then 24-hour labor and C-section. So kind of jump into some of that, the decision to go back on anti-anxiety. And my opinion on that, I'm going to throw it in, even though nobody asked. Somebody asked me the other day about breastfeeding and medication. And it was an antibiotic. And I'm like, if women are drug users and they're on methadone during their pregnancy, and they need to stay on it or the baby will die, like instantly. So if they have to stay on methadone and it's better for them to breastfeed on methadone, we're really stressed about an antibiotic. So like, I think some things in lives are your perspective, right?
Yeah.
You're talking about an opioid compared to an antibiotic. Not that we don't have to be cautious because you want to be on the right antibiotic for breastfeeding or pregnancy or whatever. So it's still important to look into it, but I think we get so caught up with, you know, worrying about affecting the baby, which we should be, when I know that in every category, anxiety being this category, there's one that's fine.
Mm-hmm. You're right. There's absolutely.
It's fine. Yeah. And it's better to take care of yourself than the alternative. So
100%.
That's my opinion anyway.
Yeah, I agree.
So
I'm glad that I went back on it and I had two kids after my first one and was on it the whole time. And the pregnancy was much less anxiety provoking.
Yeah, I imagine. Well, tell me about the 24-hour labor and the C-section, because that's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, so my water broke early. I was like 38 and a half weeks, and it wasn't like a gush, you know, like you see in the movies. It was like
it never is.
I was like, I think my water broke. This is weird. And so then I get to the hospital and the nurses like didn't believe me because they're like, the first baby, you're never you always go over 40 weeks. We doubt that your water broke, but we'll admit you. Okay. Take, you know, do the strip to see. And they're like, oh, your water did break. Okay. So yeah. I was like, I'm not lying, you guys. Like, but my contractions weren't hitting fast enough. So they put me on Pitocin. Yeah. I got an epidural. I was very like, it's so funny.
Conveyor belt. Labor conveyor belt. Right.
Yes.
Right.
If I would have had a baby now, it would be a much different experience. But you know, in my 20s, I just didn't have any idea really. And just the information wasn't readily available as it is now. And the different alternatives, and I didn't even know what a doula was like, you know? So I'm barely like progressing, but you know, like I'll hit it. Okay. Now I'm, you know, dilating. I get fully dilated. I finally start, and at this time they wouldn't let me leave the bed. So, and I could only have ice chips. So I'm going on my water broke in the middle of the night. So I'm over like 24 hours of no food and no liquid. And I'm just drained. I'm so exhausted. And they're like, okay, go ahead and start pushing. So I start pushing for like an hour and she's just not getting past my pelvic inlet. And my doctor wasn't on call. It was another doctor who I'd never met. And he was like, you could keep pushing, but like, honestly, I would go with a C-section, you know? Ah. And so I was like, oh, and at that point I was so exhausted. I didn't care. I was like, you can take her out my nose. You can take her out my nose. I don't care. But then I felt this overwhelming sense of defeat of like, there's something Aww. Wrong. And I remember apologizing to my, I'm so sorry that I couldn't do it vaginally. I'm so sorry I couldn't do it. And he's like, I don't care. I don't care. And like the baby was in no distress, but because I was approaching the 24 hours of having my water broke, they were like watching that clock. And so they're like, you gotta do something. So I said, fine, take her. I don't care. And then she came out and everything was fine, but it just, the breastfeeding, I'll never forget when they were like, okay, we're going to massage your uterus afterwards. And like how they push down on your
bundle massage. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh. That is the most painful thing I have ever been through in my entire life. I was like, so that was traumatic, but I mean, otherwise it was, I mean, it really wasn't a traumatic birth. I don't want to, you know, say that lightly, because I know there are people who have very, you know, traumatic births, and mine was not. It was, I would say, disappointing and exhausting for the two words
that
categorize it.
Yeah, normal, right? Normal that it's disappointing. I mean, yeah, and that's, I think, you don't know what you don't know, and we go into labor that first time. I mean, I think I went in totally blind, and I only didn't get the epidural because the anesthesiologist noticed I was pushing, but nobody else did. Or I would have done, I was on the same sort of conveyor belt, because you go in and you're young and you've never done it before and you don't even know the questions to ask. Oh, and then you come out the other side and you're like, wait a minute. That doesn't seem like it was right. But in the moment, there's not a lot that you can do to advocate for yourself when you don't even know what the options are. And it's very, at the very least, defeating. And then you have the recovery, and you said you have no family around, right? So
no,
you're exhausted.
My mom was going to fly out, but my daughter came early. So then it actually ended up being nice, because I was in the hospital for 3 days, because that's how long they keep you when you have a C-section.
Still.
And so then by the time she got there, I had just gotten released from the hospital. So that was nice. My mom was there for like 2 weeks and was super helpful. But I honestly was like, okay, well now, I mean, I'm an intelligent person. I knew exactly, I read all the pregnancy books, but then I was like, well, now what do I do with a baby? Like, can't be that hard, right? Like, morons have babies all the time and like they can wing it. And I just was like, why isn't she asleep? Like, nobody tells you, at least back then, nobody was like, it's really freaking hard. It is. Some of them don't sleep. And I had heard the word colic and I was like, I don't understand what any of that means. I'm following all of these steps and like nothing's working and I'm so tired. And my body, like the weight did not magically spill off. Like everyone kind of like said that it would or had modeled. I felt like I looked like a deflated balloon when I came out of the hospital. And so then, you know, you're dealing with your own body image issues and oh gosh. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot. I think here's the issue is like, say there are 20 things that could happen postpartum, right? But you're going to get six and I don't know which six they are. Yeah. So I'm always like, why are people so sharing every negative story that the most negative story that they have? They see somebody pregnant and feel like it's okay to verbally vomit the most negative thing possible. And that makes me frustrated. But then women don't get information. And here's the thing, it's going to be hard. I don't know in what way for you.
Yes.
It's going to be hard, but it's going to be the hardest thing you ever did. I remember telling my daughter that. And she's like, well, I've been a nanny and I've done this. Over all things, right?
Yes.
All things. And I was like, 100%. And that gave you a lot of experience. All I can say is it's not going to be the same. And it's going to be hard. And I don't know how.
Yeah.
And later she was like, I don't know if being a nanny prepared me at all. And it did. Yeah. It absolutely did. But we don't know. And I hate sharing negative stories. Like one woman was like, nobody tells you your hips will spread 3 inches and never go back. Well, I mean, I was happy about that. That was no big deal for me. And maybe it's not the same for everyone. So it's so hard.
Yeah.
And then you do it again. So
Yeah.
how did you move forward through that and having more kids?
I think we just knew that we wanted three kids. Like we just were, I was a big planner. So I was just,
yes.
Okay. And I researched, and at the time the research was showing that, you know, the best sibling spacing was 2 years, in terms of like long-term relationship, closeness for when they're adults. And I was like, okay, yeah, like I can do that. I'll knock up. I can, you know, and like, there's this fear that if I waited until I was older to have kids, that like there would be much more likely to have genetic issues, or I'd have a hard time getting pregnant. So there, again, there's this push, to have babies when you're young, like use, you know, those most, young eggs, use them up.
Yes.
And so, yeah, so I was like, okay, so right around, what's 9 months minus 24, whatever that 14, 13, 14 month mark is. I was like, okay, so she's walking now. She's, you know, like talking, and like, she's still really needy. She's still super clingy. Like, okay, but maybe it'll be better with two. And so I got pregnant right away and had a schedule. I was trying for a VBAC.
Okay.
And the doc that happened to be on call when I was like around 39 and a half weeks, because they did like a, I can't remember, like a heart rate of the baby. And they noticed that it was decelerating. And they're like, I'd feel really comfortable admitting you. We're going to keep a monitor on you. And they just didn't notice it improving. And so they're like, you know, we would like to admit you and, you know, start the whole process. And I said, well, I'd really like to do a VBAC. And the doc on call was like, I don't feel comfortable doing a VBAC. I think that there's, you know, too much of a risk, blah, blah, blah. And so he said, so if you want, we can do a C-section tomorrow morning, blah, blah, blah. And I said, okay, fine. So
it's hard to fight the system. You know, there are things that make me so angry about pregnancy. And one of the things is the doctor will say, you have double the chance of uterine hemorrhage. True story, right? Of someone who hasn't had a VBAC. It goes, it's like 0.05 to 0.1. Like, they're not lying, but they're not telling you the truth either. Or they're not giving you all the information. Like, you have almost no greater chance of uterine hemorrhage than someone without a VBAC. But it's how to word things without lying. But also, teenagers are great at this. We can talk about that too. Like, massaging the truth, or like telling part of the information, or completely not lie. It's not a lie. It does double. But they don't tell you the rate, and that makes me furious. So you had a second C-section, then you have two, which obviously two makes it better. You know what makes it even better? Three.
Three sure does.
Yes. Three's the hardest.
So my, again, 14 months later was like, okay, like
it's time. Natural
knock out another
spacing.
Kid. So the first month I didn't get pregnant, but the second month I did. And so I do recognize that that's not the case for a lot of women, is getting pregnant that easily. And similar pregnancies, first trimester really sick, and then afterwards, you know, it got better for the most part. But when we did the anatomy scan at around 20 weeks, they found that my son had a club left foot. And so that was something that, you know, they were like, well, there's a couple of indicators. We don't think he has Downs, but these are some of the things we're concerned about. You know, like the foot could correct itself on its own, but we're not really sure. And so then I was like, okay. And then about 3 months before my son was born, my husband's in the military, and so we got orders to move. And so we knew that a month after my son was going to be born, we'd be moving from Washington State to Texas. And that makes care for a baby with a club left foot a little bit challenging, because you need to do the serial casting like pretty much immediately within the first 2 months of life. Yeah. So that was, you know, something to deal with. So I had three kids who were four and under, about to move to Texas and dealing with a club foot diagnosis.
So I had a diagnosis. We were also military.
Oh, okay.
It's crazy. I love the common denominators. And I ended up flying. It was my first child, though, and I ended up flying to where my mom lived for the end of my pregnancy because of the potential issue with my daughter. That's a really hard situation to be in. People don't understand that unless you're in that situation. So did you end up, what happened with the end of the pregnancy and the casting and everything? Was he born with a club foot?
He was. Yeah.
Okay. So it was a correct, because you know, there's a 15 to 20% chance they're wrong.
Right. Right. Yep. So he was definitely born with it. So within the first, I think when he was 6 days old, he got his first cast. And that was fun because people looked at me like I abused my kid, because you have this little newborn baby with a cast, like all the way up from his hip to his foot. And changing diapers was, oh gosh, a nightmare, because that cast is like right up there on their, you know, towards their hip. And so that was stressful. And then we had to go back every week for the first 4 weeks to get a new cast, because to whatever they were doing. And then they put him in what's called a, I think it's a Ponseti bar. I mean, my son's almost 11, so it's been a long time, but it looks like a snowboard. Like, so he's got his little feet like that are out, they're turned out, and it looks like a snowboard. And again, people just were like, what, you know, just a lot of stares and confusion. And, so then we moved to Texas, and thankfully the doctor up in Washington had a good relationship with the doc down in Texas and was able to get us in right away. But, you know, I think it helped that my husband was also a physician and we knew how to navigate, you know, the military medical system.
Yes.
But I could see how easily people could fall through that if they're not on top of it, because it's a huge thing. You have to get, it's not like you can just show up to the hospital. You have to wait to get registered within the hospital system, you know, like switch everything over. It's not as simple as it may seem.
No, and it's not.
It's very complicated and time consuming. And you don't have time with a 5 week old who has a clubfoot. Like, you need to be getting serial casted and having that check, those checkups in a certain time period.
So you have three kids, you move to a new place. I mentioned your book at some point. Are you still married?
Still married. Yep.
Okay. Same person, but you guys left the church.
Yes, we left the evangelical church. We switched to more of a progressive, non-denominational Christian church. But in the last few years, we've stopped attending church. Mm. We still identify as Christian, but I would, you know, some people would say, well, if you're not going to church, then you're not a Christian. So,
I mean, we could have an entire podcast just on that. Same thing for me. I mean, when I left the Mormon church, I felt like it wasn't my faith or beliefs that stopped me. I felt so overwhelmed in how to move forward too, that I didn't go for a long time. And then you find a place and then it's not quite the right fit. There's a lot that goes into that. Yeah. So, but I divorced and left the Mormon church and switched. And so good for you for getting, there's some tough stuff you have to get through in being married. So you've been married for like 20 years now.
Yeah. We celebrated. Actually, yesterday was our 19th anniversary.
Look at me doing math in my head.
I know. Good job.
Congratulations.
Thank
you. Okay. So I want to fast forward. You have three kids, which I think is the hardest. I thought three, like I did fine with one, fine with two. I thought I was a genius. I had three and I was like, holy cow. But then after that, it was fine. But for some reason, three, and you have a son that was born with a developmental need, a medical need, and you've moved and you're military and eventually you leave the church and then somehow bridge the gap between your book and your business and that life. 'Cause that might be a big jump. I don't know.
So when I was, when my daughter was in, when I had one kid, I went to graduate school and got a master's in human sexuality. Okay. And then when we moved to Washington State and my husband did his residency, I got a second master's in mental health counseling. And so during that time, I opened up a mental health and sex therapy practice and was an adjunct professor at a university and taught human development, sexuality classes. And then we got orders to move to Texas and I had to close it all down, and now I'm in Texas and not working because the licensure laws in Texas were different than Washington, and they didn't have reciprocity, blah, blah, blah. And then we're there for 3 years. I do some speaking. I talk to parents about like how to talk to their kids about sex. I do some consulting work. And then we moved to North Carolina. And that's when I started really getting into the coaching world, because I was like, oh, I don't have to have a license to be a coach, and I can still help people.
Right.
And so that's really what allowed me to set up a practice there. And then we moved again. This time we moved to Germany, which we are at now. And that's when I started to write my book and really wanted to help more women, because I felt like I was dealing with facing so many of the same clients who were dealing with the same issues, feeling sexually broken and feeling like there was something wrong with them.
I think, well, I have opinions on everything, as we've already established. I think coming from a really strict religious background, and there are lots of them. I mean, Catholicism, if you're strict, is one of them. Absolutely. Jehovah's Witness, there are a lot. And yeah. I feel like in these religions, you're told, no, 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 it's bad, it's bad, it's bad. Yep. And then you got to get married, you got to get married, you got to get married. And then at your wedding, they're like, here's your chandelier and your Superman cape, go. And you can't feel like something is bad and wrong and dirty and secret your whole life. And then flip a switch. I also think that there's a gross lack of education about, especially for women, but like men don't get the map. You know, there's a whole situation happening. They don't have the map, and women don't know how to tell them that.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, I don't have the map either. I have like no experience. Nope. And you put that them together and tell them, go have babies, get married. And your job is to have babies. And that means you have to have sex, but you have no, and I don't mean sex education, like the physical, this is what does this and how it works. I mean, like the real map. This is an emotional thing, a physical thing. And you have this massive drive to want it. And I just saw in the Mormon church with friends, a lot of sexual dysfunction in relationships because they never bridge that gap.
No.
But I know it's not just with strict religions. I just know it's very apparent, in my opinion, in a strict religion. It's super apparent, because we're not messing around as much.
Absolutely. Well, and I wanted to make a point when you were talking about how like this thing is bad. I wish that people only thought that. The problem is that they think I'm bad because I have sexual thoughts. And so then now we have to deal with this whole suitcase of sexual shame, because not only is this thing that I've been denying horrible, gross, weird, wrong, I don't even understand it because it's bad, but I desired it because that's how I'm wired there, because that's how our bodies are designed.
Right.
So there's something wrong with me on top of that.
I mean, then let's just say that didn't happen. You had positive sexual experiences in the beginning. You were with a man that was patient, and you were patient, and you explored, and it was positive. I think then, you know, women, then you get pregnant, then you mentioned body image after you have a baby and feeling like a deflated balloon, and recovering from that. And the fact that I think if that wound from having a baby, well, yours was on the outside, your C-section scar, but if we put the scar from where the placenta detached, if our uterus was flipped inside out and you could see it on your body, people would be like, don't get up, let me get that for you. But it's not. And we are dismissive of ourselves and our feelings. I think women are very dismissive of what we need. And then we talk about self-care, which can be a whole tangent that ends up not being positive. So I can see why. First of all, congratulations on all your masters and everything. I'm very proud of you. That's
Thank
really
you.
Awesome. That's a lot. That's really great. Thank you. And then you published a book, and I'm very proud of you about that, because those are all hard things to do. But I can see where you, in your experience, you looked out around you and went, oh my gosh, there's such a need.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, anytime I would go and speak to women's groups, I did a lot of MOPS, like mothers of preschoolers. Yeah. So I'd go into a lot of those. And I would invariably have somebody say, raise their hand and say, my husband thinks there's something wrong with me. How can you help me? Or I would have women come to into my office and say, I'm only here because my husband is basically making me come here because we have like no sex ever. And he's basically threatening to get a divorce. And like, I could be fine with never having sex again, but I'm tired of arguing about it. So, you know, I was like, okay, ladies, we got to do something with this.
I mean, I'm on this women's running team. And I remember women talking about how there was this one run in particular, like, well, we just did it, so that bought me 2 more weeks. Yep. And it's winter, so I'm not going to shave my legs until spring. And I just said, let me tell you, if this relationship is so bad and you get a divorce, the first thing you're going to be doing is shaving your legs. And you know why? Because you're going to be getting your body and yourself ready to date again, to do the very things you're saying in your marriage you don't do or don't want to do or don't like to do. Like, I shave my legs every other day, not because it's fun and I love it, but because taking care of it feels good to take care of yourself.
Sure. Yeah.
And a side note of that is that my husband likes that I shave my legs every other day, even in the winter. And I just think we get into this mentality where he's married to you, so you don't have to do anything to keep him around, which is such a bad mentality. And if you want to have sex to buy yourself 2 weeks, something's not right. Like, you should want it every day. You should be chasing him.
Yes.
Like, that is not right. It's not healthy. And the fact that women don't feel that way or don't feel comfortable feeling that way, or the experience is not great, so they don't feel like whatever reason you have for feeling that way, none of it is okay. You should be chasing him, you know? So tell me. I think it's super common and it's super sad because I know every one of my friends and myself included, the second you get divorced, you're shaving your legs, meeting people and having sex again. All the things you didn't do in your marriage.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I think that it's so complicated, but it's so simple. Like, if women gave themselves, and really for me, what I see is that it comes down to women not believing that they are worthy and deserving of pleasure, and not just pleasure inside the bedroom, but in all areas of life. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if a woman doesn't see herself as being confident enough to advocate, one, she doesn't know what she wants because she never got the map. She's never been given permission to explore what she wants. Then how is she going to tell her spouse, hey, I want you to do this to me or that to me? Like, when she lacks the skills and tools to have that conversation, let alone the confidence to even say the word vulva, vagina, clitoris, you know, orgasm, all those things. And I get that question a lot. Like, how do I talk to my partner about sex? Like, we've been married for 10 years. We don't ever talk about it. It's just kind of something that happens. And like, I don't know how to, and I'm like, sorry, but it's going to be awkward. Like, I would love to tell you that you can make it smooth and fun. But the more confident you are in any topic, the more easily able you are to have a conversation with someone and not feel embarrassed about it. And I think that there's a lot more resources now than when I was first married, in terms of, you know, equipping yourself and like, okay, how can I, like, is this normal? How do I say this or like want this? But yeah, I think for me, like what I see for so many women is that they just don't believe they deserve pleasure.
Wow. That hurts my heart so much.
It does, which is why I do the work that I do, is because I'm so freaking passionate about women knowing, like educating, equipping, and empowering those women to know that, like, because I believe that a pleasured woman is a powerful woman, and powerful women can change the world.
I mean, mic drop on that one. I would end there, except tell me how people can get in touch with you. I know that they can do things virtually because you're in Germany.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I already kind of know who your ideal client is, but what you would tell them about, I'm imagining this person feeling resistance or embarrassment to reach out to you. So can you kind of, in whatever way you want, address that? And I know everything's in our show notes, but the easiest way to get in touch with you.
Yeah. So the social media, Instagram, I'm the most active on. So yep. Courtney Boyer Coaching. But I've been in this field. First, I worked as a sexuality educator in like a lot of high risk populations. So like think juvenile detention center with 17-year-old boys and giving them sex ed. So I've literally heard it all. I've heard everything you could possibly think. Nothing embarrasses me. And that's something that my clients really appreciate, is that even strangers appreciate. They'll be like, they find out what I do and then they just like dump on me and they're like, I'm so glad I got to talk to you. And I was like, okay, you know, whatever. But so it's okay to feel embarrassed, but if nothing changes, nothing changes. And so really take that first step to be brave and know that you're not alone. What you're facing, I've worked with hundreds of women who have already faced it, and you can feel better. Like, it doesn't have to be this way.
Thank you so much, Courtney, for being on and sharing your story so boldly. I appreciate you so much. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate you.